Well, greetings everyone and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Now, the Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on freedom of speech when we come back. You know, 3,300 years ago, Moses instructed our fathers, he said, you shall not have in your bag diverse weights, a great and a small. You shall not have in your house diverse measures, a great and a small, but you shall have a perfect and a just weight. A perfect and a just measure shall you have. Well, you know, our founding fathers at the Constitutional Convention back in 1787 followed that scriptural principle of law when they put into our Constitution at Article 1, Section 10, these 17 words. It says, "No state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debts." But in 1933, President Roosevelt took our gold away, and in 1964, President Johnson took silver coin out of circulation. Now, in place of these just weights and balances, these two presidents introduced our current practice of the first, second, and fifth planks to the Communist Manifesto into our monetary system. And they gave us Federal Reserve notes in place of gold-backed treasury bills and clad coinage in place of silver coin. Now, in the intervening 70 years or so, we Americans have gone from being the world's number one creditor nation until today, we're the world's number one debtor nation. Now, who do you think were the better financial planners for our country, Moses and our founding fathers, or Franklin D. Roosevelt and Lyndon Baines Johnson? Now, if you'd like to learn more about hard money and how to use it properly, it's another of the many lessons that we teach here in our Mosaic Law School. We conduct that school here twice a year at the law school, in the spring and in the fall. Now, if you'd like to learn more, why don't you call and order our free General Law CD package. That's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. Remember, it's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free. And you can call and order one right now. The number is 417-273-4967. You know, that's the place to start. It's our free General Law CD package. Doesn't cost you anything. That number, again, to call is 417-273-4967. Now, our Mosaic Law School is also available on compact disc for adult home school. So if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click on to the email, send us an email request for that free General Law CD package, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Why don't you do it right now while you're thinking about it before you forget. And remember, we send those out about every, two, 3 months, you know, something like that. I sent out all that I owed back in January, beginning of February, and now I got a big stack over here facing me, and I've got to get a bunch more out. So be patient with me, and we'll send you that General Law CD package and tell you what we're all about. Hey, last time we were talking about this thing of freedom of speech, and I brought up the subject of superior title. You don't have to have possession of something to own it. It's done by title. Walt Mann wrote quite a bit about that, and I gave you some information. But before I finish up with Walt Mann here, I wanted to complete our thought on this thing of payment versus discharge. So if you remember in the last program, I said, you know, little Georgie goes down to Harry Connick's and gets a loaf of bread and a quart of milk. And as he's walking home, we ask the question, who owns the bread and milk? And we find out that Daddy Gordon owns the bread and milk. It's not Harry who hasn't been paid for it, and it isn't little Georgie who's in possession. But under the Uniform Commercial Code, under the law of bills and notes, we find, oh my God, Daddy Gordon owns the bread and milk because Harry alienated himself, which is what transferred his property right in the bread and milk to Daddy Gordon under contract. Uh-oh. Now let's go back here and let's start thinking about, you go down and you buy a car. Okay? Let's just assume that you've got the money in a briefcase. And you take your briefcase in and you sit down and you talk to the guy and he says, okay, well, I got to have $20,000 for this new car. So you reach in your briefcase and you pull out $20,000, brand new, $100 Federal Reserve note dollar, and you pay the guy the $20,000, and you walk out with a bill of sale, you walk out with a title in your hand, and God, you go out and you're driving your car around, and I ask you, hey, Bob, where'd you get that car? Well, I bought it down at my local Ford dealer. All right. Then I ask you the question, I say, well, who owns that car, Bob? Think about this now. Who owns that car? The Ford dealer doesn't own it because he alienated himself from it. Remember, he gave it to you, signed off on it, gave you a bill of sale. Just like Harry Connick, he doesn't own the bread and milk. It's gone. But has he been paid yet? See, those Federal Reserve notes are not payment. Those are discharges. They're actually called a chosen action. It's kind of an odd term. You got to look that up in Bovier. Chosen action. It's a right of recovery in commerce. The Federal Reserve note isn't the money. It's the right of recovery. Look at the Federal Reserve note. It says right on the face of it, this note is legal tender for all debts, public and private. It used to say, and in Title 31 it still does, it says, and is redeemable at any Federal Reserve bank for lawful money. So the guy hasn't received any lawful money. What the hell is lawful money? It's gold and silver coin. Go back to your Constitution at Article 1, Section 10. No state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debt. I want to contract a debt from my Ford dealer, and I walk in there. My Constitution says I can't contract this debt without gold and silver coin. Now my government came in, and they said, oh, yeah, you can. Sure, we got away. It's called the Uniform Commercial Code. The Ford dealer will alienate himself from the property. All right, now, little Georgie, you're in possession of the car and you're out driving it around. Who owns it? Let's think about that one for a minute. The issuer of the note owns the car. Doesn't he? If Daddy Gordon issued a note on a 3x5 card and said, hey, I'll pay you when I see you, the note isn't the payment. The note is the contract. And that note, that Federal Reserve note, is the contract. It's payable in lawful money at some point in the future. I'll pay you when I see you. We don't know when the hell we're going to get paid. Hell, you people out there have lived your whole lives, never been paid a dime. You've been discharged the whole time. And that's why you don't own anything, and that's why Franklin Roosevelt took your gold away from you in 1933 and Lyndon Johnson finished the job in 1964. It was to destroy your right to own property. And the average Joe Sixpack American, and I would submit the average Joe Sixpack Australian, Canadian, New Zealander, or Western European, cannot connect the dots. Couldn't care less. You know, I walk into the store, I put the paper on the counter, I walk out with the goods, I take them home and I use them. That's all he cares about. But he doesn't own them. And so the policeman regulates and controls his use of guns, regulates and controls his use of his children, regulates and controls his use of his car, regulates and controls the use of his home. And Joe, meanwhile, says, this is my home, this is my car, these are my children. At the time, same time, the social lady comes in and says, hey, we're going to take your kid now, your kid, huh? We're going to take the state's kid and put him in a new foster home. We're going to take your car and impound it. We're going to take your car, your house, and foreclose on it. And that's because you don't own it. You do have an inoperable, an unseeable bundle of rights. You know, we've got this little bundle of rights over here called equitable interest holder in due course, a chosen action, a right of recovery, but not property and certainly not ownership. All right, so that's the way that game is being played. And that's why you need to get your gold and silver coin back. You know, if you could get your gold and silver back. Now, in Australia, you've got gold coin down there. All of you Aussies have your own gold coin. You Canadians have maple leaves. We Americans have our American eagles. Hell, we've got our gold coin back. That's not a problem. It's that you're not using it and you don't know how to use it to establish or to reestablish your property rights. That's the bottom line. Now, from the supposed governmental view, they are taxing, that your government is taxing us on the grant of citizenship. Citizenship, by the way, is a privilege. Did you know that? Take a look at it in Bouvier's Law Dictionary. Look up citizenship. It's a privilege granted by the state and requires reciprocity. You have to pay something for that privilege. Now, one, you're paying for the grant itself. Just the grant of citizenship you're paying for. And then, two, you're paying for the intangible property rights that reside in citizenship. And third, the government is taxing you privately in the nature of a rental or like fee for the use of the state's property or the state's proprietary private property interests as we use this property, that's your automobile and your house, generally, and as we exhaust the government's property through wearing it out on the one hand and by immediately using it up, such as eating it for our meals and so on. And that's because you've never paid for anything. In your whole life, you've never paid for anything. All you ever do is discharge your obligation in equity. Now let's take a look at an automobile. The Ford Motor Company. This is what we're talking about. Remember the manufacturer's certificate of origin. Who in the hell owns this car when the Ford Motor Company runs it off of the assembly line? There it is, sitting there at the end of the assembly line, completed. Maybe we've even tested it and started the motor and drove it out to the parking lot. You know, when you buy these new cars, you know, they typically have 4 or 5 miles on them. They drive them out to the parking lot and maybe drive them around the test track, make sure it runs good. Then they load it on a truck and haul it off to your town, give it to your dealer. He, in turn, sells it to you, and you buy your brand new car, and it's got 5 miles on it. Okay, well, now this car is sitting here in the Ford parking lot. Now, the Ford company, they write up a piece of paper. They just create it like a 3x5 card. Looks like my dad. And it says, Manufacturer's Certificate of Origin. And Larry B. Kraft explained that, and he said, well, see, it's used in commerce. Boy, you can say that again, Larry. Boy, that's true. And it comes under the Uniform Commercial Code. Yeah. And nobody ever buys this automobile. In fact, Ford didn't even buy it. They issued the manufacturer's certificate of origin. Where did they get the glass? Well, they got it from Pittsburgh Plate Glass. Okay. How did they pay for it? Well, they paid for it with Daddy's note. They paid for it with Federal Reserve notes. They didn't pay for it with gold and silver coin. They don't have a property right in the glass. They have an equitable interest in the glass. Where'd they get the tires? Well, I bought those from Firestone. How did they pay for the tires that they bought from Firestone? Well, they paid for it with Federal Reserve notes. They bought it with Daddy's notes. So who owns the tires? Federal Reserve. Who owns the glass? Federal Reserve. How did they buy the steel? Same thing. Federal Reserve. Boys and girls, the Federal Reserve, by operation of the Uniform Commercial Code, owns everything in the country, including you. Well, I've shown you that many times. Remember, we asked the Attorney General of Texas, Jim Maddox, who said, hey, is it true that the state of Texas owns our children? He says, yeah, not only your children, we own you too. Well, how'd that happen? Well, hell, your parents got you a birth certificate, didn't they? And their parents got them a birth certificate, didn't they? And their parents got them a birth certificate. Well, that birth certificate over there represents the manufacturer's certificate of origin. It's the MSO. You created it when the child was born. As soon as it came off of the assembly line, you issued a manufacturer's certificate of origin. Who'd you give it to? Well, I gave it to the state. Well, welcome, social lady. Hey, can we start to wake up and smell the coffee here? Now, you know, if we were practicing the Ten Commandment model, we'd be doing things a little bit differently. We used to. I mean, there was a time here in America when a man owned a Conestoga or Studebaker wagon. You know, he went down to the Studebaker company, and he said, I want to buy that wagon. He bought the wagon, and he paid for it with gold coin. And he walked out of there with a bill of sale that said, paid at law with gold. And he owned the gold, and he owned the wagon. And that's because he paid for it. And that's called an even exchange. You see, when you pay for something, you actually give something of equal value. A $100 Federal Reserve note costs 3 cents. It's not equal value to $100 worth of wheat. It's not equal to a $100 tire. It's a representation. It is a certificate. That's why you get a certificate of title. It's not the car. It's the evidence. Well, same thing with the manufacturer's certificate of origins, just like a birth certificate where you pass your seed through the fire to Moloch and you give it to the state. Now the state sits there with the highest and best evidence of title. And the presumption of law is that you didn't pay for it, which is true 99.9% of the time. In fact, it's probably closer to 100%. Once in a while, some guy will go out and actually pay for something. So let me tell you a little story here about a guy that actually paid for something and the different result he got. The guy's name is Robert Fox. He's probably not the best poster child for pro se litigation because of a whole host and plethora of other hang-ups that this guy's got. But, you know, it's kind of like Miranda versus Arizona probably isn't the best poster child, you know, for a Supreme Court case. Or Rodney King, a poster child, you know, for civil rights litigation. But, you know, typically criminals and other lowlifes, you know, are the focus of our judicial system when we're establishing rights or legal principles that established those rights. So Robert Fox, I guess, in that regard, comes out to be our poster child. But here's what he did. He lives in Arlington, Texas, and he went to school here at the law school, and so he said, well, I'm going to test that. And so he went down to, I think he went over to Corinth, Mississippi, and he bought a new Japanese car. I forgot what the brand was. It could be a Datsun or a Toyota. I don't know what it was, but I think it was a Toyota Corolla, if I remember the story right. But anyway, and he goes into the dealer, and he paid for it with silver coin. He had silver. He walked in. He said to the dealer, he said, now listen, I want to make a legal test here. And what I want is the manufacturer's certificate of origin. I want the MSO. And the dealer told him, he said, well, wait a minute. You cannot have the MSO. Because if I give you the MSO, then you can't get title, and without the title, you can't get license plates for the automobile. And Fox said to the dealer, I don't want license plates for the automobile. I don't want a state title to the automobile. I want the automobile. And the dealer is sitting there going, well, that's kind of crazy. Why, you can't drive that car out on the highway if you don't have license plates. And the routine is that I sell you the car, you pay me, I deposit your check in the bank, I'll get credit for it, and then I'll buy another car to replace my inventory, and I'll make a profit on it. We'll take the manufacturer's certificate of origin, send it into the state, they'll send us a title. You'll take the title down and you'll get license plates, registration. Then you'll go down and buy insurance. And, you know, that's the formula. That's the way the deal. Fox told him. He said, well, I understand how the deal is scoped out. I understand the routine. I don't want to do that. I want to own the automobile. And I want the MSO. Furthermore, I don't want to pay you with a check, credit cards, or Federal Reserve notes. I want to pay you in United States silver coin. Now, the price of the car, as I recall, is quite a few years ago now, 10, 15 years ago. The price of the car was $13,000 and some change. And at the time, I would imagine 15 years ago, the price of silver was about $5 an ounce. And so let's just take $13,000 here, divide that by 5, and it's 2,600 ounces. And so he said here is 2,600 ounce bars of silver. Or silver coin, or silver dollars, or whatever he had. I don't remember now what it was that he made the transaction in, but the transaction was made in real money. It wasn't done in gold. See, ordinarily, it would be easier for you if you had a $13,000 bill at $900 an ounce. Let's just take $13,000 today divided by $900. Would be 14.44 ounces of gold. I mean, it's a hell of a lot easier to just deal with 15 ounces of gold, ain't it? But, hey, listen, we can do this in silver. We could do this in wheat, corn, beans, honey, or oil. We could make the transaction in property. We want to pay the debt. We want to extinguish the debt. That's the key, extinguishing the debt. Now, the dealer doesn't own this automobile. Hell, he's got that thing floored through Westinghouse Flooring or GE or somebody. Now, you might find a dealer that actually bought the automobile, but he never paid for it. You can rest assured you're not going to find any auto dealers in America that ever paid the Ford Motor Company with gold or silver and extinguished the debt. Remember, this debt moves from person to person because it's a debt. We're using debt money. Money, that's a Federal Reserve note. That's a debt. That's the key to this. You're not paying for anything. That's why you don't own anything. You never paid for it. And that's the plan. The reason that we abolished gold in 1933 and silver in 1965 is so that you cannot pay your debts, so that you cannot own anything, so that we can practice the first plank to the Communist Manifesto, which calls for the abolition of all right to property. That's the purpose behind it. Now, you know, if government came to you and said, well, now, look, we want to convert you from the Ten Commandments to the Ten Planks, and we're going to start by taking your gold away from you. Well, listen, a con man can't succeed by telling you the truth. He has to deceive you. That's the purpose for con men. For crying out loud, let's wake up. And so now Fox strikes a deal with the dealer. Now, you can rest assured that before he walked in here, he'd already gone to lunch with this dealer and had this thing all scoped out, because this is a legal test. What Fox wants to do is to test this in the courts. That's the purpose behind it. It's like Rosa Parks riding the front of the bus. She didn't get on the bus and then just say, oh my God, I'm so tired. I just can't walk to the back. I'm going to sit here in the front because I'm so tired. That was the cover story. This was a well-thought-out plan by the NAACP and the ACLU to create a legal challenge. Come on. Come on, guys. Wake up here. So Fox wants to create a legal challenge. So he pays for and walks out of there with a bill of sale and the MCO. Gets in the car and drives down the road. Now, he got all the way over to Texas. Now, this poses a problem. You know, oftentimes, you know, you don't... People ask me, you know, well, how come you don't do this? Well, for practical purposes, you can't get here from here to Reno, Nevada without license plates on your car, because some cop somewhere is going to stop you and say, hey, you ain't got any license plates. And that cop doesn't understand MCOs. Most people don't. But Fox wants to do a legal challenge here. So he gets to Arlington, Texas, and sure enough, here comes Ranger Rick. He not only gave him a ticket, he arrested him for driving without a license, charged him with not having insurance, not having registration, locked him up in jail. All right, so Fox is in jail. Now, for a few days, while the process is winding its way through, the city of Arlington over here comes to a real problem. Who owns this automobile? Well, the state of Texas doesn't own it because they don't have the MCO. And the state of Mississippi doesn't own it because they don't have the MCO either. And this guy, Robert Fox, is in possession of it, and he has the MCO with a bill of sale that has extinguished the debt because he paid the debt at law. Just like he would have in 1925. You know, before we got into this law merchant paper, and then the Uniform Commercial Code, manufacturer certificates of origin, and so on, the guy could actually own the automobile. Now, we should actually go back a little bit further in time and come up to a little better understanding of, when did license plates come about? You know, you didn't need a license plate to drive your Studebaker wagon from St. Louis to Oregon in 1860. So where did we come up with the idea that you needed to have a license plate on your automobile? When did that program start? Well, the first automobiles were invented in the 1890s. And people drove them around, you know. They didn't have license plates, and they didn't have licenses, and they didn't have insurance, and they didn't have inspection stickers. So all of that came about little by little, you know, as time progresses along. Well, it starts off in 1904 in New York State. And a problem has developed. And here's what the problem is. These cars don't have mufflers on them, and they make a lot of noise. And the usual and ordinary conveyance of the day is called a horse and carriage. That's what everybody uses. And the unusual and extraordinary conveyance of the day is called an automobile or a horseless carriage, making a lot of noise, scaring the horses, making them run away, and causing property damage. So the state of New York, the legislature, comes up one day and they say, look, these horseless carriages are the extraordinary use of the highways, and they're causing property damage. We have to regulate and control the unusual and extraordinary use of the highways. Comes under the police powers. Been that way since Moses came down off the mountain with the Ten Commandments. Now you have the usual and ordinary, and then you have rights and property rights, and then you have the unusual and extraordinary, and then you have regulation and control. So how does this horseless carriage fit in? Fits under the unusual and extraordinary use of the highways. And so the police powers come into play, and yes, we can regulate the unusual and extraordinary use of the highways. And they did. And they said, from now on, you got to carry a sign on the end of your automobile, and we'll issue these by the state. We'll call it registration. You got to put these license plates on your car, this horseless carriage, because you got to be regulated. You people over there are causing property damage. You're obviously out of control. Well, that went on for a while. One day in 1914, they came up, a little before 1914, they came up with an idea of, we'll license sea captains to run these horseless carriages over here. And this licensing law goes through. Same rationale, police powers of the state regulating the unusual and extraordinary use of the highways. A guy by the name of McKenzie, it's called McKenzie versus New York, he comes into the state Supreme Court and he says, wait a minute, hang on a second. I got a property right here in my automobile. You can't come along here and make me buy a license or license me or regulate and control me in the use of my property. So the Supreme Court comes back and says, oh, yeah, we can. We can, because it's the unusual and extraordinary use of the highways, with this caveat. And the state Supreme Court said, if the automobile should replace the horse and carriage as the usual and ordinary conveyance of the day, we would have a much different case before us. That's in 1914. By 1920, the horseless carriage has now replaced the horse and carriage, and no more legal tests come up. Well, not until I started doing it, and Neelis Cook and a number of others, trying to recoup our property rights in our automobiles, based upon McKinsey. Well, okay, but we failed. By now, the automobile has been so well established as the extraordinary and unusual conveyance of the day. Listen, you don't need a driver's license to drive a horse and carriage down the road. That's because the horse and carriage is still, to this day, the usual and ordinary conveyance of the day. And the automobile is, as a matter of law, the unusual and extraordinary conveyance of the day. Now, hell, both of us know that isn't true, but, you know, that's the way the law is. Now, going back here to Fox, he walks out with the MCO. He's got a property right in the automobile. How do I know that? He's got the manufacturer's certificate of origin, didn't register it with the state. State's not involved, but now they've arrested him and jailed him. And they can't prosecute him. Well, they didn't. Arlington, Texas never prosecuted Robert Fox for driving without a driver's license or operating a motor vehicle that's not registered or not having insurance. What they did was they called in the feds and charged him with counterfeiting a passport and impersonating an ambassador, which we'll talk about when we come back, right after this. The sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that those authors or publications that we're endorsing will necessarily reciprocate. So let's keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour and Editorial Review may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Remember, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. You're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. Now, for more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's eight schools in all. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. Now, the Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives. All of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about freedom of speech. Now, the subject matter that we're using to illustrate freedom of speech has to do with property and property rights. And the reason I'm doing that is because Larry Beecraft took a position here in one of his papers. It's called Destroyed Arguments, that I fundamentally agree with and promote and use in my paperwork. But once in a while, students will ask me, well, why do you support this guy, Larry Beecraft, when he doesn't support you? And he contradicts you. Well, that's what freedom of speech is all about. We don't always agree on everything that goes on in life, do we? I mean, hell, you can be a Republican, but that doesn't mean you agree with everything George Bush does. You could be a Democrat, doesn't mean you agree with everything that Barack Obama does or Nancy Pelosi or somebody else. So we have disagreements. They're based upon beliefs, and beliefs are based upon all of this net sum total of information that comes into your mind through your five senses. And so you arrive at a conclusion. Well, your conclusion may be different than my conclusion based upon the input of facts and information. You may have more facts and information than I have, which means that you may have a better understanding of the subject matter at hand. That's what I'm contending. I contend that I've got some information here that I wanted to share with you and point out that, well, it ain't the first time you've been wrong, Larry. It ain't the first time I've been wrong. So let's see if we can put some more facts and information into the equation and come up with a better conclusion. Now, Robert Fox wants to test a legal issue. Now, Arlington doesn't want to prosecute him for the driver's license, registration, and insurance. And that's the same result that we got five times in California. And another guy by the name of Louis Meinzer bought a brand new Ford pickup, drove it down to Albuquerque, New Mexico, got arrested and jailed, and his pickup confiscated, got his pickup back. But the practical application of driving your automobile without license plates on it poses a problem, because the average Joe Sixpack policeman doesn't understand the story that we're telling you now. And in fact, the state is going to do everything they can to subvert this concept of property and property rights. Hell, they've been doing it since 1933 with the absconding of your gold. Now, if you and I want to establish our property and property rights, then the first thing we got to do is get our gold and silver back and start using our property so that we can own property. You got to buy and pay for it. Then you have to come back in here and establish your property rights under the Ten Commandment model rather than the Ten Plank model, which means we got to have a lifestyle change here. Is that going to occur for 300 million Americans? Not on your life. Hell, the people of America are happy as clams at high tide with the status quo. They're not going to change jack diddly squat. And neither are the people in Australia or Canada or anyplace else. So I'm just preaching to the choir here, and I know that. Hell, I'm not deaf, dumb, and blind. But meanwhile, back on the farm, I want to establish all of the property rights that I can. I might not get them all back, but if I can get back half of them, that's a step in the right direction, isn't it? So when this question of the MCO comes up, this lady in Colorado, she's got a good point, and she's hitting the nail on the head. She's saying, hey, wait a minute, we've lost our property rights in our automobiles. Well, she went a little bit overboard when she thought, well, the MCO is the title. It's a part of the title, lady. No doubt about it. Very important part of the title. But it's not the whole story. You see, you can't get the MCO unless you get it from the dealer. And in California, you can't even get it. Because, see, Willie Brown, who's now the mayor of San Francisco, used to be the speaker of the assembly. And so, over a period of time, when we tested this in California, Willie Brown woke up one day and said, okay, what we need is a new law. So they passed a law in California requiring all of the dealers to turn the MCO over to the state. Only the state. When you buy that car, you, as a dealer, you got to send it to the state. You cannot give that to the guy that buys it. All right. Can the state do that? Well, of course. The corporate entity over here under Hale versus Henkel can be regulated and controlled. Go back to Hale versus Henkel. So the Ford Motor Company and the dealers over here are licensed businesses in the state. And the businessman submits to that license and regulation. I've covered that for you a number of times over here, but I'll cover it one more time here. In Almeida Sanchez versus United States, dealing with this thing of hauling marijuana in your pickups there. A central difference between those cases and this one is that businessmen who are engaged in such federally licensed and regulated enterprises accept the burdens as well as the benefits of their trade. whereas the petitioner here was not engaged in any regulated or licensed business. The businessman in a regulated industry, in effect, consents to the restrictions placed upon him. So, hey, listen, if you want to be an automobile dealer in California, then you consent to the restrictions placed upon you. So the state comes in and they say, well, we'll put a chokehold on this private property crap right here where it counts, and that's with the dealer. So in California, you can forget it. That doesn't mean that the other states have all followed suit. There's actually one state in the union, Nebraska, where you can get the MCO back from the state, or at least you used to. They were the only state that still would let you do that. When you junk the car out, you could do it. Now, there's one more important little caveat that goes with this thing here that I guess I ought to bring to your attention. There was a story of a guy that had a machine gun. He was down in, it was Arizona, I believe it was. And let's see if I can find his case here. I think it's in Hale versus Hinkle here, dealing with rights. Let me see if I'm right here. Here we are, Hale. Let me flip over here, too. And it's a guy with the machine guns. Let me see if I can tell you that. Yeah, here it is, right here. San Francisco, California. Federal appeals court Thursday overturned a Mesa man's federal conviction of possessing 5 machine guns. A 3-judge panel of the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in San Francisco reversed the conviction, ruling that the congressional ban does not apply to homemade machine guns and their parts because they were never in the stream of commerce. And the court ruled that there was neither a transfer nor sale of the weapons or their parts. So Congress did not have the power under the Commerce Clause to regulate homemade guns crafted from scratch. Ah, very important property right here. See, Congress has reserved to itself under our Constitution, and this is our Founding Fathers, this is the Achilles heel of our Constitution. It's Article 1, Section 8, called the Commerce Clause. Congress can regulate any and everything under commerce, like it or lump it. So the minute that Ford makes an automobile, they can regulate it, unless it's property. But it can never get into the stream of property and property rights because it's always in the stream of commerce. There's an exception, though. In legal theory, if you could manufacture your own automobile, like, you know, Duryea did in 1895, he manufactured his own automobile. He didn't need a license or registration. It was property. But when they started selling these automobiles in commerce, then they could be regulated under the police powers, especially since they were the unusual and extraordinary conveyances of the day. That's the way life is. Now, the Supreme Court, as it relates to regulation, has said a number of times, and this is a part and parcel of Anglo-Saxon administration, going back to Mount Sinai again, that yes, you can be regulated for the health, safety, and welfare of the public. Let's take a look at an ancient welfare or health, safety, and welfare regulation. It's called quarantine. So God comes along one day and he says, hey, listen, you got some guy in the camp here who's sick. Put him out of the camp. Quarantine him. Can the man be regulated? Well, ordinarily he has rights. Ordinarily, he can walk around in the camp. Ordinarily, you know, he can do all the things that everybody else can do. But wait a minute. Once this guy contracts tuberculosis, and he's walking around hacking and coughing and sneezing and spitting and spreading germs all over hell, can we regulate and control this guy's behavior? And the answer is yes. Of course we can. We don't have to, you know, walk around being subjected to tuberculosis because this guy's got rights. He can be regulated. Eminent domain's another case in point. King David wanted a guy's piece of ground over here. He needed it for a sacrifice. He needed it for government purpose. So he comes over. This guy's name was, I think it was Naboth, but I might be wrong there. Naboth might have been the guy that got ripped off by Ahab and Jezebel. But anyway, David needed a piece of ground. And he said to this guy, hey, I need your piece of ground over here. How much do you want for it? And the guy said, well, for crying out loud, you're the king. I guess you can just take it. And David said, no. No, I'm not coming in here and just taking it. You know, we need it for public purpose, but you got to be paid for it. And so the government, in this case King David, he said, well, how about taking this for the property? And the guy said, yeah, okay, I'll take that for the property. That establishes eminent domain. Hell, this has been around in our administration for thousands of years. I'm not proposing something brand new. I'm proposing that property and property rights ought to attach to your home. They used to. They don't anymore, but they used to. I'm suggesting that property and property rights ought to attach to your automobile. They used to. They don't now. Probably won't for a long time to come, but they ought to. And the manufacturer's certificate of origin is a part, an important part in this process of the Uniform Commercial Code in transferring your absolute property rights to the state and making it a qualified property right in which the state has some input into it. So when we go back here to property and property rights again, listen to this. But property and personal goods may be absolute or qualified without any relation to the nature of the subject matter, but simply because more persons than one have an interest in it, or because the right of property is separated from the possession. A bailee of goods, though not the owner, has a qualified property in those goods, while the owner has the absolute property. Personal property is further divided into property and possession, and property or choses an action. So your automobile has three primary owners. It's the state number one, the bank number two, and you number three. All three of you have a qualified property right in your automobile. Robert Fox had an unqualified absolute right in his automobile, as evidenced by the state not prosecuting him. Well, they prosecuted him for something else. Well, we can talk about Robert Fox and ambassadors and counterfeit passports. That's another subject for another day. He won that case also. But the thing that's important is the property right in his automobile established by the manufacturer's certificate of origin. Come on, guys. It's the only thing this guy's got. Everybody else has got a certificate of title. Now, I told you the story here early on, so I'm going to tell you once more. When I did this in Idaho, I didn't have the MCO. Never, didn't even know what it was. Never heard of it. And until I just mentioned it on this program, I'll bet you that 99% of you people out there never even heard the term MCO. Didn't know it existed. Well, it does, and it's an important document. It's true that it exists for the purposes of import and export. But hey, listen, most automobiles sold in the United States are not imported and are not exported. So that MCO has some other meaning, just like a birth certificate on a child. You don't have to have a birth certificate for your baby. That's voluntary. You get it if you want to. You're cunningly coerced into always getting one. It's because you always have your baby in the hospital. Just like you always buy your automobile from the dealer. You don't have to. I mean, you know, you could do something else. You never get the MCO from the dealer, but you could. I mean, if you put your mind to it. Sometimes you got to be insistent. Sometimes you got to tell people, well, if you don't do that, then I'm not going to buy from you. And what we're looking for here is a dealer that's willing to sell the car for cash, paid at law with gold or silver coin, and get the MCO and walk out the door with it. Now, you still got the same problem. You're not going to be able to drive the car out on the public highways without the license plates on it, because the cop is always going to stop you, and then you're always going to be in court litigating. And then when the case is dismissed, then you go out and get in your car, you'll have another ticket before you get five blocks. Now, when you take this to the appellate process and try to get it adjudicated for a policy decision, it's called a mere regulation of commerce. a mere regulation of commerce. Well, back in 1827, Justice Marshall and the Supreme Court came to a conclusion. They said, we will not review the mere regulation of commerce. Now, your state has a vested interest in driver's licenses and registration. It's a multi-billion, hell, it might be in the trillions of dollars of business nationwide per year. So the state does not want to give up driver's licenses, registration of automobiles, in favor of private ownership of private property. The state is engaged in denying you and eliminating private property, which is why the state has adopted the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto, not only as a philosophy, but as a unit or a rule of law. That's the way it is. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court could review it, but they won't. And I've been there three times trying to get them to do it in three different guises, but they don't want to. So there you are. You know? If the Supreme Court said, we do not want to review blacks riding the front of the bus, they could say, we're not going to review it, period. All right, so now what are you going to do? Now, if we could get the court to do that, that would be a step in the right direction. But it's not very likely that that's going to happen. Now, there's one more little caveat that goes with this. I'm going to flip over here. In Virginia, back in 1930, there was a story that came down. And it had to do with automobiles. Let me see if I can find it. Yeah, here it is. It's called W.L. Thompson versus D.C. Smith, having to do with automobiles. And a provision of a municipal ordinance relating to automobile driver's permits, authorizing the chief of police to revoke the permit of any driver who, in his opinion, becomes unfit to drive an automobile on the streets of the city without prescribing what shall constitute unfitness, and a provision authorizing the exercise of the same unlimited discretion by the judge of the municipal court upon an application for reinstatement of the permit, are both void as delegation of legislative power to officers acting in an administrative capacity. So what had happened here was there's some little town, and they enacted a city ordinance and said the chief of police can take your driver's license away from you. Well, the last state in the union that required driver's licenses, as I recall the story, was Oklahoma in 1939. So why do you need to have a driver's license? Well, a license is permission to do something that's otherwise illegal, unlawful, a tort, or trespass. And the reason you need a license is because you're creating a tort or a trespass on somebody else's land or property. Now, we've always had what we called rights of way. A right of way. And then this right of way is condemned by eminent domain for the benefit of the public at large to travel upon. So, early on, they came to the conclusion that automobiles were the unusual and extraordinary use of the highways, requiring a license or permission for you to trespass upon the rights of other people using horses and carriages. Now, of course, the horse and carriage has totally replaced the automobile has totally replaced the horse and carriage. But we haven't made the corresponding leap or the corresponding change in the law. If a horse and buggy is property and property rights in the usual and ordinary conveyance of the day, when it changes to the automobile, we should have a property right in our automobiles. We don't, but we should. And who's going to bring this to the attention of the courts? Well, it may have to do with the way that we bring it to the attention of the courts. But here's what automobiles come up with in Virginia back in 1930. The right of a citizen to travel upon the public highways and to transport his property thereon, either by automobile or horse-drawn carriage or wagon, is not a mere privilege which a city may permit or prohibit at will, but it is a common right which he has under his right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. So the Supreme Court of Virginia, as recently as 1930, said, hey, listen, traveling up and down the highway over here, either by automobile, a horse-drawn carriage or wagon, is not a privilege. Got that? Now, of course, you know, you've been to school, and they told you that driving is a privilege. I don't deny it. But it hasn't always been a privilege. It used to be a right in this country that has now been converted to a privilege. And so, of course, the question arises, well, how in the hell did these government agents convert our right to travel into a privilege to drive? And the answer is they did it through the Uniform Commercial Code. And they did it by taking our gold and silver away from us with our consent. We just merely consented to it by failing to object timely, until now the doctrine of latches has overtaken us. And it could well be that the courts have simply looked at George Gordon and said, you know, Gordon, you're a nice guy, we like you, but latches has overtaken you. Your failure to assert your right timely between 1914 and 1980 has simply waived the right. Although I'd like to have some court tell me that, you know, come up and say, well, wait a minute, we think latches is the problem here. Now, the right of a citizen, the court goes on, says, the right of a citizen to travel upon the public highways and to transport his property thereon in the ordinary course of life and business is a common right, which he has under his right to enjoy life and liberty, to acquire and possess property, to pursue happiness and safety. It includes the right in so doing to use the ordinary and usual conveyances of the day, and under the existing modes of travel includes the right to drive a horse-drawn carriage or wagon thereon, or to operate an automobile thereon, for the usual and ordinary purposes of life and business. It is not a mere privilege, like the privilege of moving a house in the street, or operating a business stand in the street, or transporting persons or property for hire along the street, which a city may permit or prohibit at will. So if you're going to use your automobile here for commercial purposes, such as a taxi cab, that's commerce, and that can be regulated and controlled under the Commerce Clause. Now, the automobile of and by itself is an article in commerce because you bought the automobile with Federal Reserve notes or some form of credit. Then you never got the MCO. That went to the state. They issued you a certificate of title, so they've got an interest in it, and then you probably have a lien at the bank. So it's a commercial transaction, which is totally a privilege. And so when government is regulating your automobile by taking the manufacturer's certificate of origin, registering the automobile, and then giving you a certificate of title with a lien from the bank, is all commercial and it's all an object of commerce, and nobody's got any bitch coming. But hey, wait a minute, guys. That does not mean that the manufacturer's certificate of origin is merely a piece of paper that has no meaning. It's got a hell of a lot of meaning. Meanwhile, back on the farm, I'm out of time again, so I'm going to have to remind you that you have been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log, schedule, and archives, all of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Well, time's up. We've got to leave it right there. I'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.